Talking about beauty turned out to be quite complex for me, interestingly enough. My hopes for this service were really about seeking beauty, being open to beauty, and also practicing the beauty of learning. Learning what the truth is, the complex truth is about beauty. And it's also about the fact that beauty has such an important role in my personal life. I rely on beauty on a daily basis for my well-being, for my inspiration and my soul work as well. I need beauty. So I would like to read a poem by Barbara Jordan, who was the first Black woman U.S. representative in Texas. She was also an accomplished poet. She writes this: "A reptilian sheen in the sky, a predatory darkness wincing with stars. In this cup of creation, the wind descends and lifts the trees, lifts my heart and the tiny hairs between my shoulders in a blowing fire. I will give my life for this love that boomerangs light years. I will walk to the edge and memorize the sky. What I fear is the wilderness, not the earth's, but the spirit's wilderness, where there are abandonments beyond description. I remember the beautiful dilemma on the mountain, the compulsion to fly over the valley, the exigency that held me and left me subdued. What shall we believe beyond the natural law? The earth is bread we take and eat." And I'm also aware that beauty to me is not necessarily beauty to you. Some of you may have felt touched by that poem, and others may have felt it was strange or even not okay on some level, uncomfortable. And so part of understanding beauty is knowing that we are different, and we are saved by our Unitarian Universalist tradition, which combines the freedom of pulpit and your freedom and responsibility, the freedom and responsibility of all of us to make our own decisions based on our own experience and our own exploration and our own thinking. Part of the reason to focus on beauty is its relevance to all of our personal spiritual growth, our individual well-being right now, today, but also that of our group, our group. So for me, it seems in addition to the rising sun that I watched reflected red on the clouds this morning, the scattered, beautiful wisps, poetry does bring much beauty for me. It speaks for me, as does science, both of which, poetry and beauty, and excuse me, both poetry and science, include and actually require complexity. I am drawn to paradox, and it turns out that the concept of beauty itself is loaded with paradox. If you look, if you feel so moved, at the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, it says, among the ultimate values with goodness, truth, and justice, beauty is a primary theme. Among the Greek, the Hellenistic, the medieval philosophers, and it was central to 18th and 19th century thought. In Western philosophy, philosophers argued for at least 100 years about whether beauty is in the eye of the beholder or if beauty is objective, an aspect of a thing that is inherent, part of what is. The Philosophical Encyclopedia says each of the views sketched has many expressions. some of which may be incompatible with each other. It's worth remarking how divergent or even compatible these views are. For instance, that some philosophers associate beauty exclusively with their usefulness, and other philosophers exclusively with their uselessness. Is beauty perfect proportion, perfect unity? As Sappho said famously, some say thronging cavalry, and some say foot soldiers, and others call a fleet the most beautiful sights the dark world offers, but I say it's whatever you love best. Schiller, a philosopher, says that beauty performs the process of integrating the natural and the spiritual, or the sensuous and the rational. And only in such a state can we be free. So in all this arguing, where the understandings of beauty were polarized and argued about for a long time, reflecting developments in technology and science and art, many in the West sought and still continue to seek Eastern philosophies that bring the two together, that bind good and bad together, that bind light and dark, beauty and strife as wholeness. So maybe that's part of why I'm drawn to paradox, as it's critical to remedy the bifurcation, the pressures that polarization seems to create between what's possibly seeming untrue when one case is stated up and against another, but in fact, they may both be true. So, paradox, it turns out, is critical in the perception of many theologians of different religions and also religious educators, because it's an understanding that for us to move along in some growth, it doesn't have to be from here to there in a straight line. It's more often, you know, wandering around cyclical or on a path that is our own. But that the understanding is the more that we're able to integrate paradox, the reality that there can be one truth, one understanding of reality that in fact seems opposite from or contradicts the other fact, the reality is that we can live with those with more comfort, and it expands our understanding of what is true, of what is real, and what is beautiful. So truth, it seems, grows as we allow our awareness of paradox to grow. So here's where science comes in for me. It was in an amazing interview between Krista Tippett and Frank Wilczek. And you know, were you there for the interview? Is that what you're saying? I see a big smile. Frank Wilczek has written numerous books. And I'm guessing he may be controversial in the physics world. Maybe not. I see a who knows. I'm not sure. But he won the 2004 Nobel Prize in Physics. He's the Hermann Heschbach Professor of Physics at... Feschbach, Professor of Physics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. I, by the way, sat down next to Brian and said, I'm really glad you're here because I'm going to make mistakes. This is about physics. I have a woolly mind. Tell me when I make a mistake. So this is good. One of his books is called A Beautiful Question, Finding Nature's Deep Design. It entertains the question, does the world embody beautiful ideas? Does the world embody beautiful ideas? So she was asking the question, Krista Tippett, whether Asking if the world embodies beautiful ideas is anywhere in the neighborhood of finding out what the meaning of life is. And he said, actually, very, very related to each other. They're very similar. They have similar feelings to them. And he said, well, I sure wouldn't know how to answer the question about the meaning of life. But we do have a lot of data, a lot of evidence for uncovering the beauty in life. And so, let me say this, quoting him. Beauty is a human experience. It's something that has to do with how humans react to the world and perceive it. And it's notoriously thought as subjective, but it's not entirely subjective, he says. There's a rich history of art, objects, and music, and what people have found beautiful, and literature, and we can compare that to what scientists find in their deep investigation of what the world is, and see not whether those things coincide, because they clearly don't coincide. There are forms of beauty that are not found in science, and there are facts about the world that are not beautiful. But there are a remarkable intersection, a remarkable overlap between the concepts of beauty that you find in art and literature and music and things that you find as the deepest themes of our understanding of the physical world. Now, there were a number of concepts that he explored, and my muzzy mind could handle one of them, and perhaps not completely well, but the concept is called complementarity. He says, in ordinary reality, in ordinary time and space, the opposite of truth is falsehood. That's how we operate in the world. But, he says, deep propositions have a meaning that goes beyond their surface. You can recognize a deep truth by the feature that its opposite is also a deep truth. Called complementarity. He says, when people ask me what my religion is, he responds by saying, I'm a complementarian. This rule of nature that he sees, of science, is that important to him. The existence of contradictory truth to him is that central to him. So here's an example that I could work with, that light is both particle and wave. So I see some nodding heads. You understand it better than I do. And what he says, because I'm not going to try to explain it, during coffee hour there may be a clutch of people who really understand this and can explain it to you. Who's willing to explain that light? Brian says, I'm too tired. I don't want to have to work. Anybody would like to explain to somebody, raise your hand and let other people know that you're willing to talk about this complex idea, okay, that light is both wave and particle. And what he says, Dr. Wilczek, is sometimes it's useful to think of light in one way. Sometimes it's useful to think of it in another way. And both can be informative in different circumstances, but it is impossible to apply them both at once. He continues and says, I think that's the essence of complementarity. You have to view the world in different ways to do it justice. And the different ways can each be very rich, can each be internally consistent, can each have its own language and rules, but they may be mutually incompatible. And to do full justice to reality, you have to take both of them into account. Another example that I could grok is that complementarity exists when you talk about what it means to be a human being. Because in, you know, a scientific mind, we're particles and waves and impulses, not a lot of control. And in another way of looking at being human beings, we're full of thought and feelings. And he says, I think they're both true. They're different ways of organizing our experience of the world, and each one tells us important things. Each one can be very useful in certain applications, but they're very difficult to apply simultaneously. They're just from different worlds, he says. He says, one thing that nature, one thing that nature is, learning from nature means that we are learning about useful ways of getting around in the world. That nature has hardwired us to recognize in many circumstances as beauty, things that are important for us to know to be able to get around in the world. So things we can learn from, new experiences that can help us in other endeavors give us pleasure because we're hardwired that way. And learning about the world and learning about how strange it is and then being taken by surprise, learning things is expanding your concepts, your power, your appreciation of the world. So I think that it's beautiful. It's intrinsically beautiful to learn things. I'll finish with his saying, the world in large part does embody beautiful ideas, that if you regard the world as a work of art, first of all, it helps you understand things. And secondly, it's a pretty good work of art. It is tremendous beauty. It has tremendous creative power in using a few principles to make elaborate structures. It's a wonderful thing, he finishes. And some of you will resonate with my confession that it was pretty frustrating to figure out how to write a sermon about beauty when all I wanted to do was for us to show each other pictures, sing each other songs, tell dreams, do what we understand to be beautiful. So what I've done is identified a few passages from Mary Oliver. This book is one long poem. It's called Leaf and Cloud, The Leaf and the Cloud. And I'll read parts of it, hopefully without doing violence to it. Upon the rocks grow beautiful small things, mussels with mossy beards, dark blue shells. They sigh as the tide rises. Starfish cruise and cling, bluefish plunge and leap, their long bodies swirl. Their teeth are uncountable. The tides rise, the blue sprawl and polish climbs the rocks and is momentarily held there. The loggerhead with her pink parrot's head feasts among the mussels. Daylight descends slowly, and the now that is a day becomes the now that is a boat. A white moon, a white heron, the only fisherman left on the black rocks. In my mind, the arguers never stop, the skeptic and the amazed, the general and the particular in their uneasy relationship. Then the robin sings. Then the bulb of the lily becomes the stalk. The stalk opens into a handkerchief of white light. Oh, what is beauty that I should be up at 4 a.m. trying to arrange this thick song? What is beauty that I should bow down in the fields of the world as though someone somewhere made it? Oh, what is beauty that I feel it to be so hot-blooded and suggestive, so filled with imperative, beneath the ease of its changes, beneath the leaves and the clouds, of its thousand and again a thousand opportunities. Are you afraid? The ear of corn knows whereof it is plucked. Are you afraid? The wind moves this way and that way. Something is pushing it. Are you afraid? Somewhere a thousand swans are flying through the winter's worst storm. They are white and shining. Their black beaks open a little, the red tongues flash. Now, and now, and now, their heavy wings rise and fall as they move across the sky. Listen, I don't think we are going to rise in gauze and halos. Maybe as grass, and slowly. Maybe as the long-leaved, beautiful grass. I have known, and you have known, or the pine trees, or the dark rocks of the zigzag creek hastening along, or the silver rain, or the hummingbird. I look up into the faces of the stars, into their deep silence. This is the poem of goodbye, and this is the poem of don't know. My hands touch the lilies, then withdraw. My hands touch the blue iris, then withdraw. And I say, not easily but carefully, the words round in the mouth, crisp on the tongue, dirt, mud, stars, water. I know you as if you were myself. How could I be afraid? And lastly, the pickerel swims up from the pond, from its roses of slow decay, and looks at me astonished. What is it I need to know? The gypsy moths, still caterpillars, wrench themselves from the milky shreds of birth and set out on the long journey in the shining tree. What is it I don't know that I need to know? Think of me when you see the evening star. Think of me when you see the wren, the flowing root of the creek beneath him, dark, silver, and cold. Remember me. I am the one who told you he sings for happiness. I am the one who told you that the grass is also alive and listening. Alleluia. Alleluia sings the pale green moth on the green's door. Alleluia. Alleluia, the red tongues of the white swans shine out of their black beaks as they shout, as their wings rise and fall. Rise and fall, oh, rise and fall through the raging flowers of snow. I hope if that you enjoyed or felt connected to some of what was here in this poem that you pick this book up. It is a powerful book. The hymn that I would like us to sing together is For the Beauty of the Earth. When I was probably 12 years old, I told my dad that this is the song I wanted them to sing if I died before he did. I didn't know about complementarity then. Page 21, For the Beauty of the Earth.